Hi, everybody. Good to see you again. Today, really pleased that we've got Michelle Russo to talk. She's Executive Vice President for Global Communications for Discovery. And she's somebody with a very interesting and successful career, somebody who's been involved in two presidential campaigns, communications, one winning, one losing.
I think we won both.
We can talk
about that later.
Right, okay, right. Yeah.
Yeah, 2000, we just didn't get the White House.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah. And has also worked for the FCC, the communications regulator in the States, and sometime since 2004 for Discovery, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Good. And Discovery has been around for three decades. Michelle's going to talk about how, in a sense, you know, we now think of Discovery as very much part of the global communications kind of furniture, a major, major brand, but when it originally came on the scene, was very much a disruptor, a very much a kind of new player in the way that it it was shaped and the kind of material it produced and the way it was consumed. And she's also going to talk about, of course, now the challenge for a company like Discovery in this new media environment. So please, warm welcome to Michelle Russo.
Thank you, Charlie, for the kind introduction. It's been a mostly successful career. We didn't get the White House in 2000, but I do like to say I worked on two winning U.S. presidential campaigns. I'm so pleased to be with you here tonight. I did a Master's of Communications at Annenberg at USC, which I know is a partner. Although I went to UCLA undergrad, so I'm a Bruin at heart. We can talk about that later. But my mother's a professor at USC, and so I did my master's work there at Annenberg. And my favorite lectures, among the brilliant professors we had, of course, were the guest speakers and hearing from practitioners out there in the real world, because I was so eager to start my own career, and I wanted to hear from those who'd gone before me. And so how did I land at my dream job at Discovery? It's been an interesting path. You probably saw my bio before class tonight, so I won't repeat it, but I will just make a few points that I hope are relevant advice for you as you chart your own careers after you finish your formal studies here, which is, for some strange reason, this is very odd for someone at a young age at the time, in my early 20s, I just knew I wanted to be the head of communications at a big media company. I mean, that's crazy. I don't know where I got it, but I had it in my head that that's what I wanted to do when I grew up. I'm sure I haven't grown up quite yet, so there's still some years ahead, but I just knew that. But I didn't follow a linear path. I did start out at a media company, but along the way of my career, I always seized opportunities where I could put my communication skills and learnings, my formal education, and the skills I was getting in different jobs, and test them in different environments. And whether it was politics or a regulatory agency at the FCC or TV companies or a PR agency, I always tried to disrupt my own self and challenge myself to go into jobs that I was a little bit afraid of, a little unsure whether I could do them or not. And that's just kept me growing and learning in my career over the years. And I strongly recommend you approach your own career with the same kind of fearlessness and willing to take risks, because then when you're at a company, especially in a hugely disruptive industry like media, but media is not the only thing being disrupted right now. Everything's being disrupted. Hotels are being disrupted, taxi services. There's so much disruption across all sectors right now. But media is particularly fun, and I've enjoyed the time I've spent here. As Charlie said, Discovery's journey has been about disruption since day one as well. They disrupted the broadcasting business by launching a channel focused on documentaries, and satisfying curiosity was the mission of our founder, John Hendricks, who started the company in his garage in Maryland over 30 years ago. And it was the early days of pay TV in the US, and there were channels launching like CNN and HBO and MTV and ESPN, and he thought to himself, why not a channel with the kind of content I like to watch, which is content that is entertaining, but also educational and inspiring, like some of the best documentaries. And our partners at BBC were huge in our first early filmmaking endeavors. So they were founded on disruption. We quickly became a leader in pay TV in the US, but we also knew that there was something special about the stories we were telling at Discovery, and that those stories were universal in nature and would probably travel well around the globe. And so Discovery disrupted as well a few years later in 1989 by being the first big US media company, or one of the first big US media companies, to launch channels internationally. And we launched Discovery Channel in the UK and Northern Europe in 1989, which was quite remarkable at the time. Instead of just sitting back fat and happy in the US, we decided to venture abroad. So before I show you a short video about Discovery, because we like videos to do the talking where possible, I'm curious what you might already know about Discovery Communications, because it's my job to make sure people know about the company, but I always know I have more work ahead of me. So this is a classroom, so I want to give you a pop quiz. I'm not going to pass out paper, but tell me something you know about Discovery besides Discovery Channels. Just yell it out. Do you know any other channels that we operate or own? Do you know some of our favorite shows? We bought Eurosport, yes, we're going to talk about that. Yes, we're in the sports business now, unbelievably, very disruptive. What else? Shark Week. Global franchise, getting more global every year. It's a national holiday in the States, Shark Week. Really, it has become a national holiday. So we're trying to do that in more markets around the world. My colleague Sarah did some fun stunts in Finsbury Park last summer for Shark Week here. What else do we know about Discovery? Discovery Networks Online. Yes, we do have a couple online networks. That's great, and do some short form content. Ever heard of Oprah Winfrey? We have a channel with her in the US. Okay, pretty good. That's the advantage and disadvantage of kind of the name on the door. The corporate name is also the biggest channel brand. So people associate us with Discovery Channel, and everyone says, oh, I love Discovery Channel. And I say, we also own Eurosport. We also own TLC. Do you like ID? Just to try to fill out the story a bit more. But just a little bit about financials. You're studying to be media executive, comms executives, and you should always understand how to make money in your business, whatever business or sector you're working for. And so last year, our reported revenues were about $6.5 billion. And we've done that growth, you know, consistent growth through the 31 years for all the reasons we've demonstrated so far and we'll talk about tonight. But one key differential for us is even during times of recession or times of massive disruption, we've always continued to invest in our business. And now half of our revenues come from outside the US, from international markets, which is why I moved to London 2 years ago. We've spent about $4 billion in Europe over the past couple of years. And the CEO asked me to move to London to be closer to those investments and telling our story in markets around the world outside the US. And so as we've continued to invest in content, we've diversified the content beyond traditional documentaries and beyond the pay TV business model. So how have we disrupted ourselves? Well, this slide gives you a quick summary. We have a broad geographical footprint all around the world, as you saw in the video, more than 200 markets, an average of 10 channels in every market, and beyond factual into entertainment and sports and kids. We're the number one kids programmer in Latin America. It was a market that, you know, Disney is such a big stronghold in many markets with kids programming. But Disney made a decision years ago to not invest in kids programming the way we were investing, and we outpaced Disney and kids in Latin America. It's a huge brand for us in Latin America. So we have a number of global brands, Discovery, TLC, Investigation Discovery, Animal Planet, Science. But we've also acquired, and we've grown those organically, but we've also acquired a number of big local channels. So you saw in the video, we're in the top three portfolios across the Nordic markets. We did that acquisition in 2012. These are big broadcast channels where we have big entertainment type of shows. And then, as your colleague pointed out, we bought Eurosport a couple years ago. To be honest, we saw the power of sports programming in the U.S., and we weren't in that game in the U.S., and we were losing value in terms of, or losing opportunity to create new value from our pay TV portfolio. And so with the Eurosport transaction, we were able in one transaction to have two sports channels and a big presence across Europe. But we've changed the strategy for Eurosport, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And so we've also diversified beyond pay TV into free-to-air channels, as I said. So those are big advertising businesses. And then direct-to-consumer businesses, which is a bit nascent, but we're growing more and investing in those every day as we speak. So we're in over 220 markets, or in over 200 markets, 220 countries and territories. And no two are the same. The market dynamics vary. But an example of our willingness to take risks, we have a quick case study on Italy. Italy, in 2010, we had just our pay TV, our global pay TV brands, and pay TV is not widely penetrated and distributed in Italy. It's less than 40% penetration in pay TV, whereas in the U.S. it's over 90%. And so we had 0.5% of market share, so it wasn't considered a big growth opportunity. And back in 2010, that was when, you know, the economic recession was still going on around the world. But instead of retreating, we decided to lean in, and we invested during the recession. And one of the competitive advantages of the company is that, yes, we were started in the U.S., but we are truly a global company that's run by local experts. So the person who runs Italy is named Marinella Soldi, and she knows Italy like nobody knows Italy, and she's able to find opportunities to create value and create new businesses for us. And so given the low penetration and the low market share in Italy, we have this massive library of content that we've been creating for audiences around the world for, in 2010, for at that point, 25 years. And most of the people of Italy had never seen that content. And so she launched a couple free-to-air channels with basically our library of content. But it was new to that audience, and so that's it was a very low-cost way to get bigger reach with our content. And that strategy continues on. And through that organic growth and those launches, as well as acquisitions of other media assets in the market, this one example, Switchover, that we did in 2013, that media company wasn't even for sale, but because Marinella knows everyone in Italy, has great relationships in the market, she was having lunch with someone, and somehow they came up with the idea that Discovery should buy this channel, and then we ended up with, now in Italy, we're the third biggest broadcaster, and we have 7 free-to-air channels and 6 pay TV channels. It's a massive growth opportunity market for us. So we're third behind Rai, the state-owned broadcaster, and Mediaset, which is the Berlusconi assets. And so now in Italy, we have pay TV, we have free, we have an AVOD service, which is ad-supported video on demand for our free channels, and we just a few months ago struck a deal with Vodafone to bring our free-to-air channels. That content is now on mobile phones across Italy. And who thinks their mobile phone is important? Like, it's a pretty important device in our lives. Last week was MIP, which is a big kind of media market in Cannes, and one executive was quoted. I couldn't believe the statistic, so I had my team track it down. I was like, did someone really say, is that true? Young people, when asked if they would rather give up their mobile phone or their sense of smell, 53% said they would rather give up their sense of smell. Sign me up. Like, I can't live without my mobile phone, but it's related to taste. I wouldn't enjoy food as much anyway. It's a remarkable statistic, but then you think, gosh, I can't believe it's not higher, to be honest. It's become such an essential device in our lives. And if Discovery's strategy is to make our content on all screens that you want to consume content on, you know, that's the journey we're on, and that's the disruption. You could consider that disruption, or you could consider that an opportunity. If there's, I forget, there's a statistic, like 1 billion TV screens in the world, but 7 billion devices, including mobile screens. And so that's a much bigger, we could look at that, oh no, or we could lean in and invest against that trend. So regardless of a market dynamic across 220 countries, one thing remains consistent that those of us in media know. Content is king. It was a phrase that was coined a number of years ago. And at the heart of it is great stories. People love great stories. It's literally embedded in our human DNA from the early days of man. That's how history was passed, family stories, sitting around a campfire. People love great stories. And that's why our strategy for 31 years has been to invest in loved content and then leverage it and use it across our unmatched distribution platforms around the world. We now spend close to $2.5 billion on content every year. And that's because we know the power of a great story and TV as a medium to be a uniter of big events in our lives. The last US presidential debate / reality show got nearly like 100 million viewers. I mean, unprecedented. And I'm still able, thank goodness, to watch Saturday Night Live skits on the US presidential election while I'm over here. We can talk about that after class. But we had a big global TV event last year called Racing Extinction, which is about the health of our planet and the rate of species extinction. And we did a big global air date around that. Every Discovery Channel in the world aired it on the same day, and we tried to create a lot of awareness around that content. And a couple of years ago, some of you might remember, Nick Walenda crossed the Grand Canyon on a tightrope. That was on Discovery, and millions of people watched that and held their breath. I held my breath for 22 minutes that night with my laptop right here in case something went wrong. But, you know, the power of TV to create these big unifying experiences for people is undisputed. But we know the audience is changing, the way people want to consume stories is changing, and so we constantly have to push ourselves to keep ahead of those trends. Some say the king is dead. And the media industry in particular is quite narcissistic in that, and Charlie can probably speak to this ad nauseum, loves to cover itself. And and so our stories, being a spokesperson in the media industry has its pros. They love to cover themselves. Media loves to cover media. But then the cons is there's always predictions about the death of one form of media or another. And we know that to be true from our studies in programs like this. But also, but what we forget to realize is that it just means that media consumption is expanding and people just have more and more ways to consume it. And so those are the trend lines we like. And for all the noise in the marketplace about disruption, live linear TV viewing is still pretty strong. If you pick up the newspaper, you would not think so. But we know, because we track this data around the world every single day. And in the UK, the average viewing time is 3.3 hours a day of just sitting down and watching TV when we've programmed it for you. And in the US, it's 4.3 hours. And those numbers, yes, they're going down, but very gradually. I mean, it went from 4.38 in the US last year to 4.33. So it's a gradual decline. But we do know it is declining, and we know we need to do things in multiple ways. And we know that the consumer, what technology disruption has done is put all of you and myself, my own consuming behavior, more in charge of what you want to watch and when you want to watch it. But we do think it's a long live the king situation. And we call this the age of omni-content, content that creates fans and builds communities, the opportunities of which are infinite. And nothing illustrates this more than the biggest news story in media over the past couple days of the big telecom giant in the US, AT&T, buying Time Warner, the owner of massive global brands like CNN and HBO, for 80 over 80, I think it's $83 billion. That's massive value creation in the media space. And a number of our stocks got a nice lift out of that. But it really just underscores the point of content being king. Also, it's important to note that AT&T, being a very U.S. business, Time Warner then opens up international growth opportunities for it, and that's why Discovery has outpaced many of its peers, because we were early to invest internationally. And so now this gives AT&T bought DirecTV a year ago, which is another just U.S. company, mostly small Latin America business, but now this gives them some global upside and opportunity. All right, so all of this demands a new way of thinking, and we've tried to do that for our history. But the globalization trends have created really two opportunities. There's space for locally relevant content, and there's also space for high-quality international titles. And our competitive advantage at Discovery is that we have people on the ground in all of these markets, and we know that great ideas can come from anywhere. So a great show developed for Italy may be able to travel to markets around the world. In the UK alone, we work with 70 different production companies who are surfacing ideas either for this market or for us to take around the world. And we're not afraid to take big swings and think differently. I mean, from the Eurosport acquisition alone, what does a company that was making documentaries about dinosaurs know about the sports business? Well, not a lot, you could argue. But what we do know is how to create locally relevant channels in markets around the world. And Eurosport had a great name and brand. It was one of those like, yeah, I've heard of Eurosport. Yeah, I like it. Do you ever watch it? No. Why not? Well, it doesn't really have the sports I like. I just watch it on BBC or whatever. It just didn't have local relevance because it was very programmed in a very homogeneous way across the continent. But we've invested heavily in sports rights for Eurosport to make the channel more local, more premium. Sports people want to watch, not just like wood chopping competitions. Yes, it was on Eurosport, wood chopping. And more exclusive. And so we're the home of Grand Slam tennis across Europe, and we literally shocked the sports and the media world nearly a year and a half ago when we disrupted the model and we acquired the rights to the Olympic Games across Europe starting next year until 2024. It was the first time a broadcaster had ever bought all the rights across Europe. And so now we're on this journey to bring the Olympic Games to more screens and more people than ever before. And we'll do this through our own platforms and owned properties that we talked about, but we'll also partner with some of the biggest and best media companies across Europe to do that. We struck an Olympic partnership with the BBC and other big players across the continent. So the company has, staying on the theme of disruption and technology, you know, a long history of using technology to drive our storytelling and make the viewing experience more immersive and what we call closer to real, because our stuff looks great when it's presented, you know, in as closer to real presentation as possible. We were early on HD and launching HD channels. We actually partnered with the BBC on Planet Earth, which many people, if you're from the UK, you just give BBC all the credit, but everyone else in the world watched Planet Earth on Discovery. And that was a big breakthrough because it was done, along with the BBC, invested in the HD technology. It cost us more to make that series, but it was a real driver of HD adoption back when Planet Earth launched. We experimented with 3D a number of years ago and learned a lot from that experience, and now we've been leaning into virtual reality. We were the first media company a few months ago to launch a global VR app. Again, it's a great way to get new audiences introduced to the brands and the content, and we also have a VR app for Eurosport, where we had Djokovic at the French Open, took the camera around the court and did some fun stuff for us. The talent loved getting really excited about it. Bodie Miller, the skier, put a VR, we wired him up with the VR equipment, and he did the Birds of Prey run in the States and then watched it on the VR goggles. And he was like, oh my God, this is like skiing. I can't believe it. I gave it to my 10-year-old son to watch, and he kept going like this. And I was like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm trying to make him crash. And I was like, well, it's Bodie Miller. I'm sorry. You can't make him crash. You know, it's like, but it also underscored for me, like, my son wants to be in control of that content. I can't just get like, no, Bodie makes it down. He makes it down the mountain. But my son was trying to control it in that way. And I just thought, oh gosh, we gotta keep doing more. We gotta keep pushing ourselves to keep up with these guys. So there's always lots of new exciting technology to advance our storytelling capabilities, but we also need to stay mindful of the power of TV as a medium itself. And we've done lots of studies around this. And when we talk about TV, people talk about the death of TV, but often they're talking about that big box in a living room that is primarily where a lot of the economics of the media business comes from, because that's what's measured and that's what's sold. But we know people are consuming media on different devices all the time, outside of the living room, outside of the home, but we're not necessarily paid on that. So we have to kind of continue to push the industry to develop the metrics, and then the commercialization, the monetization will follow. So that's where it's been like a, you know, we have to a careful balancing act with how much we're leaning in on these other devices that aren't measured, and thus we don't get any credit for them from advertisers. So we're always trying to push the industry forward on doing that. But we know that long form premium content is a fantastic advertising environment. And if you're trying to build brands and elicit an emotional response with viewers, there's nothing more powerful than that type of environment. In fact, it was announced a couple weeks ago in the advertising trades that the world's biggest advertiser, one of the biggest consumer goods advertising companies, had changed their strategy and their marketing spend. They had shifted a lot of dollars over to targeted Facebook ads, but they realized while they were effective in some ways, it had limited impact on brand building, and you really need more mass market marketing dollars to build your brand's relevance. And the fact is, we all know our own consumption of short-form media. You're checking Facebook, you're checking your BBC World News feed, you're checking, you know, it's a very distracted kind of experience, and you're often flipping between many things at the same time. We did a study of 9 markets, and including the US and the UK, and we looked at the different environments and put the same ad in different environments, and then did a study on recall of the ad itself or the messaging around the ad. And it's not surprising that when people were engaged in a long form piece of content and a story, they were more likely to recall the ad and recall the message associated with the ad than if they're just flipping around. And finally, to put things in perspective, Total TV is attracting 500,000 viewers any given minute. YouTube, 8,000. And of the 500,000, Discovery is attracting 83,000 any given minute with our content. But we know we can't just stand there and say, we're great, this is how it's going to be forever, and we have to do both. So we're investing heavily in digital and new forms of media, because we know we have to put content where the consumers are. Last week we announced a venture in it's mostly US based, but where we combined two of our millennial online brands, SourceFed and Seeker, with some other online brands called The Dodo, Thrillist, and Now This News. That's the one I knew the most. I don't know if any of you had heard of The Dodo or Thrillist. But we combined them into one entity called Group 9 Media. And on day one, that became one of the biggest social video companies in the world and is a huge generator of traffic and sharing on Facebook. So we're continuing to do both. The bottom line is we're never going to stop disrupting ourselves at the company or trying to disrupt the industry to always stay ahead. It keeps our jobs exciting and challenging. It's kept me at the company for 12 years. I never thought I'd be there for 12 years because, like I said, I was jumping around every couple of years to try something new, but the company has changed so much. There's always been new frontiers to charter to staying at this company. And it's very important to me, and we know this through research that we do about attracting the next generation of talent into our company, it's very important to me to work for a purpose-driven company, a company that's dedicated to satisfying curiosity and making a difference in people's lives with stories that educate and entertain and enlighten and hopefully make the world, you know, a nicer place to live through shared understandings of the differences among us. We announced last week a partnership with the World Wildlife Federation to try to double the population of tigers. That was in the wake of the Racing Extinction Initiative I mentioned in that documentary that we aired a year ago. And among the things that I'm proud of in my career, 7 years ago, I launched our Global Volunteerism Day. It's called Discover Your Impact Day. And one Friday every June, everyone at our company gets that day off and they go out into their communities and they paint schools and they feed the homeless and you know, read to school children. And it's the best day of the year at the company. And it's what keeps me inspired and challenged and growing.